Welcome to a patron-only edition of No Cartridge Audio. My name is Trevor Strunk, at Hegelbon on Twitter. You know where I am on Patreon because you're a patron. Today I'm going to be talking about Night in the Woods again. It's our third podcast on Night in the Woods, but this is on a sort of strange little subsection of Night in the Woods called Demon Tower, which is this little game that your character, May, is given for free on her laptop by your friend Angus when he fixes it. It's like this nice little... in terms of the plot, a way for Angus, this character who May doesn't really know, to start becoming a friend. And so this is Angus in the story is basically like your friend's boyfriend. And so he is this ancillary character who becomes a more central character as the game goes on. The game itself, though, is what I'm really interested in. And so it's, to describe it, people have called it a roguelite. It is that in a lot of ways. It's basically like it has roguelike qualities where enemies and level designs are procedurally generated, I guess would be the way to say it, kind of random. The characters who actually come out in each level could change. You could run into, you know, six of one type of enemy in one run through and then zero in the next. But it is level-based as well. There are particular bosses at the end of every level, and it does have an ending, right? So in a lot of ways, it resembles Dark Souls, not in terms of anything but aesthetic, but it takes place in terms of this really dark, distressing area with a lot of characters who look kind of grotesque. It's all pixelated and SNES-style, like, retro graphics, so disfigured is sort of like, and grotesque are sort of like, relative terms, but you know, the screen says you died when you died. The tone of the difficulty, right, it ramps up difficulty as you go on to the point that by the end of the game it is actually quite difficult to make it past the second to last level. There's like a lot going on in this game that is about Scott Benson, and he mentioned this in the interview, his love of Dark Souls. But what I'm really interested in this game is why it's there in Night in the Woods and what it does as this sort of game within a game. Because the idea of a game within a game follows this tradition that's found in literature, from quite long ago. You could go back as far as Don Quixote or 1001 Arabian Nights, but you could also just kind of go to the sort of locus classicus for contemporary English literature, or literature in English, excuse me, which would probably be Hamlet, in which Hamlet puts on a play within the play, presenting sort of like the murder of his uncle Claudius, but in play form. This also recapitulates the plot of Hamlet as well, of course, unbeknownst to Hamlet, insofar as the play ends in tragedy and the actual play Hamlet ends in tragedy as well. Shakespeare does this a ton. However, there's plays within plays all the time, and they're usually sort of these narrative, ironic foils for Shakespeare. Early novels use them too, to sort of slightly different effect. Tristram Shandy plays around with it a lot in terms of like stories that Tristram Shandy's uncle tells. Prior to Tristram Shandy being conceived, the whole novel is this 600-page epilogue to an autobiography, and we never actually get to the conception of Tristram Shandy because I don't mean birth, I mean conception. If you haven't read the book, it's actually great. It's a fantastic book. But the they play around with stories within stories here in this kind of delaying tactic that Lawrence Stern uses in Tristram Shandy to great effect. We probably shouldn't go into Tristram Shandy at this point, but it's this recursive text that goes back and back and back and back and back and repeats itself with a difference. And so stories within the story are one way of doing it. Furthermore, there's a philosophical aside in Nathaniel Hawthorne's House of Seven Gables, in which two of the characters are on a train and they hear this massive philosophical aside that comes out of nowhere about, you know, basically like rejecting property and throwing away all sorts of capitalistic values from this guy on the train. It lasts, 12, 13 pages in a 150-page book. It's very strange, but again, a form of this treatise within a novel. In contemporary fiction, usually you get novels within novels not as narrative foils or even as sort of thematic foils, but as a telling analytical move, kind of like playing around, a little punning. This shows up in the Crying of Lot 49, in which Thomas Pynchon uses the idea of kind of a text that exists outside of the novel, or a series of texts that may exist outside of the novel, as like a tell or a way of playing around with his character's expectations. know, this happens in Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire, or Nabokov, depending on how you want to pronounce his name, wherein the poem in the beginning of Pale Fire is actually not the story of the book, but in fact the annotations of the poem are. Or House of Leaves, very contemporary popular horror novel that deals a lot with sort of like a novel within a novel, a frame story, right? The idea of someone finding a journal and then reading the journal and then having the things that impact that happened in the journal happen to them. And finally, even in video games, we see this. The Talos Principle does this, right? Popular sort of portal-like that played around with the concept of, you know, an AI in a training simulation, training to, like, take on all the world's information after humanity has been wiped out. So in short, the text within the text is, at its least refined, a kind of narrative foil, sort of thing of saying, like, here, see what's happening in the play, it's happening again. Just in a different register. And at its most refined, it's kind of a recursive self-critique. So in Talos, for instance, since we're talking about video games, it's this way to present video game logic, you know, the idea of information being available by way of gameplay in a video game itself, the sort of like curving back again and again and commenting about itself. So the self-commentary isn't quite, however, I think, what Demon Tower is about. So Demon Tower could be about a lot of things. In terms of plot, it does have that kind of narrative connection of the narrative foil, right? You play as a pale cat who's climbing up this tower of blood, who, you know, you're just trying to make things right. It's constantly dark, depressing. It gets harder and harder. Your surroundings get more and more uncomfortable, unfamiliar. You have to trust these sort of strange people that give you advice. And finally, at the end, you have to solve this great problem of like a giant bleeding cat, right? Which, you know, in a lot of ways could be Mei herself. Although, as Scott pointed out, a lot of this game was not created by the main Night in the Woods team. So any sort of like literal representation there, we might want to give it a little bit of grain of salt. In terms of gameplay, it's a place where the difficulty of the game, and Scott said this as well, comes through a bit, right? Night in the Woods isn't hard, really in any way. In a lot of ways, it sort of feels like a visual novel, but Demon Tower is super hard. It's very difficult. It took quite a while to get through for me. And I'm fairly used to playing games like roguelites or roguelikes. And this game by the end was pretty tough. And in terms of thematics, I mean, like the pale cat, the seemingly endless journey, like I said, it reflects the kind of thematic quality of Mei's journey, right? The sort of, crushing or unfamiliar or vaguely terrifying qualities of the whole thing. And then even like the ending, you're standing on top of a tower looking into the distance. It kind of like nothing's changed, but you feel a sort of freedom, much the same as ending of Night in the Woods. That's not really spoilers, but you get the idea. But it strikes me that this kind of like, you know, 1-2-3 analysis misses a crucial part of Demon Tower, which is that Demon Tower is super fun. Not the Night of the Woods isn't fun. It's also super fun. But Demon Tower is fun as a game itself. It's like actually the sort of like contained experience. You know, it reflects, as I say, the influence of Dark Souls on Night in the Woods, as well as classic gaming itself, right? There's this kind of like joy of seeing the grotesqueries in Dark Souls, for instance, or Bloodborne. Bloodborne would be sort of the operative function here. It's also, like I said, it's like a very trendy game. It's retro gaming. It looks like something you could sell on the Steam store. You can only sell it there if you can pronounce it. And you'd be fairly successful. I mean, it's exactly what people like to play these days. It's kind of like a slimmed down graphical thing, referencing back to sort of Legend of Zelda style, early Legend of Zelda style game mechanics and Dark Souls style aesthetics. It would totally be a hit. But it's thrown in here as a palate cleanser. It's just different, right? It's this different moment in the game. It's not narrative. It's pure action. And furthermore, beyond that, it's its own unique universe. It is kind of its own thing. The universe of Demon Tower doesn't actually touch, aside from sort of like conversations back and forth, it doesn't touch the universe of Night in the Woods. It's not as if, you know, Pale Cat arrives in Possum Springs. It's like its own thing. So that actually seems like the most important thing to me and how I tend to read Demon Tower, which is that it allows a kind of introspection that the game can't quite get at otherwise because of its, and this is intentional, it's not a flaw in the game, but its extremely close focalization through Mei. you know, May's introspective, of course. She's thinking about herself and thinking about her surroundings, and that's what, you know, that's why the game shines so well. But Demon Tower reveals actually another universe that's autonomous and untouched by the outside world, just like Possum Springs is, both in terms of this kind of like contained town cut off from productive America, as we've talked about, like its approach to capitalism, or the game's approach to capitalism, is as this thing that cuts you off, keeps you out, right? If you are no longer valuable in the market. And that creates a sort of isolation, but it also creates a kind of autonomy. The game itself is also this sort of like, it's appealing to a kind of autonomy, a way in which like the game exists outside of any other outside reference. And Demon Tower totally does this. Demon Tower just exists in the game. It's even called Demon Tower 4, but we don't have to know about the previous three Demon Towers. We don't have to know anything about it. It just presents itself and then ends, affects nothing, and is affected by nothing. And unlike everything in Possum Springs, Demon Tower, as Angus says when he installs it on the computer, is still pretty good. It's this thing that remains untouched by the development of time between its release, ostensibly much before the game, and now. Furthermore, the violence, the plotline, and the conflicts of the game reflect those of Night in the Woods, but only because of proximity. You can draw these sort of analogs between the two games, but only because they're in the same game. At its core, Demon Tower is a reiteration of Night in the Woods' commitment to autonomous and intentional construction, an aesthetic object that exists whether or not, we might say, May or the player touches it at all. And here's the other thing, you don't have to play Demon Tower. You can leave it totally untouched on your laptop. It doesn't matter. You can play it through, you cannot play it through. It does not matter to the production of the game. So it truly is sort of disconnected from the thing entirely. It's just this object that exists within the universe that is untouched by any sort of player interaction. It doesn't change whether you play it or not. You know, you might change one way or the other. That's, you know, art can have an effect, but you cannot have an effect on the art. Your perception of the art doesn't change it. Unlike, say, something like, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but unlike, say, something like, well, you know, the sort of classical version of this is like a Donald Judd sculpture in a particular room that, you know, the room has a kind of effect, the sculpture has a kind of effect, everything has a kind of effect, and the only way that it actually produces that meaning of itself is if you're there viewing it, right, experiencing all the aspects of it. Or when Tony Smith drove with students from his Cooper Union classes down the then unfinished, in 1951, New Jersey Turnpike, producing an effect for all of them, but an effect that relied on their observation, right? The only reason that was like an effect in the way they described it was because they were there in the car and they saw it. The Turnpike itself didn't change. The Turnpike as art was created because there were artists there viewing it. Demon Tower as art, however, just exists. It doesn't matter if you play it or not. It exists as a coherent and intentional autonomous piece of art that the game produces and doesn't need you to look at one way or the other. The difference between it and the Jersey Turnpike is that it was created as a coherent piece, whereas the Jersey Turnpike has a functional project that artists then interpreted to make something subjectively meaningful out of. Demon Tower, then, is this sort of repetition of the final moral of the game, the moral that May reveals to her friends in the end, and again, no spoilers, it's fine, that there's no changing the existential quality of our world. There's always something hanging over us, or something that is problematic, or something that is just too big for us to handle. But there is distraction, and distraction actually is, like, to May, and I think to Night in the Woods, the sort of only consolation we get as humans, right? It's we earn it, as May says, by making it through day by day. Every time you make it through a day, you sort of earned yourself some distraction. It's a kind of version of self-care that's rooted in a truly sort of existential and material sense of the world. There's no moral to Demon Tower, that is, and we'd then add that perfectly fits the non-moral totality of the world in Night in the Woods. So thanks, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. Definitely go check out Night in the Woods if you haven't yet. And keep an eye out. There's going to be a blog post coming out about it. And then we're going to move on to, unpredictably, to Nancy Drew. Nancy Drew sort of adventure games suggested by patron Alana Farr, friend and patron Alana Farr. I think it'll be a lot of fun. And I can't wait to go through them with you. So thanks for listening. And I'll see you next time.